Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's an Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin this hour. Lots of questions in already because it's an internet Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and caring for Luna today. Luna the Wonder Dog, who we have occasionally seen in the background. Yeah. That's kind of fun to see Luna walking around. She does not seem particularly interested in apologetics, Jimmy.
No, that's because she doesn't speak much English.
I see. She's one of those dogs.
She knows a few commands, but not. She's not fluent.
Okay, fair enough. I won't give out the phone number because, as I said, all the questions are from the internet, and we've got lots of them. So back to that we go. This comes from Flame of the West. That seems like a pretty big job. Flame of the West, 6196. Hi, Jimmy. What does a real paranormal investigator do? And what methods do they use compared to all, quote, ghost hunter, sensationalist types out there? I've had a couple of genuine experiences myself, and I don't fall for the bogus methods, spirit boxes, SLS cameras out there. I'm Catholic and certainly don't think everything is demons, again in quotes, and I don't believe nonsense like tarot or go looking for these encounters. Just curious if there's any real scientific research in this area. Thanks.
Yeah, there is. And there is scientific research. And there are even classes you can take in scientific approaches to investigating paranormal experiences like apparitions of ghosts and so forth. I've taken those classes. I'm certified as a paranormal investigator with the Office of Paranormal Investigations. And I have earned a certificate of investigating the paranormal, a scientific perspective. And so there is a scientific way of doing this. Now, it is field research because you can't bring an apparition into the lab and do tests on it. There is also laboratory parapsychological research, but that's a different thing. This is kind of like going out in the wild and, you know, observing lions and tracking lions as opposed to hauling a lion into the lab and doing tests on it. It's kind of the same thing. And it's very different than what you see on ghost hunting shows. Ghost hunting shows are entertainment, and they are not remotely scientific, even if they claim to be. And they are, well, entertainment is about the kindest way to put it. So if you actually take competent classes in paranormal investigation, one of the things they're going to really hammer is do not do what you see on ghost hunting shows. You have to have an entirely different approach. One of the things that's different about the approach is a lot of ghost hunting shows don't want to have anything to do with witnesses. Sometimes ghost hunters will say, oh yeah, that anything a witness tells you, that's just anecdotal. And what they want to do is go into an allegedly haunted location, and frequently they'll lock themselves in. Frequently they'll do it at night, and then they run around with electronic gadgets and have spooky things that they put on film for entertainment purposes. None of that is what happens in an actual paranormal investigation. In the first place, you don't dismiss witness testimony. Witness testimony is the reason you are there. You know, there's so many locations in the world, you can't go to all of them wondering, oh, could this place be haunted? You go to the ones where there are some people who have actually reported experiences there. And so you don't want to just dismiss witness testimony. That's one of your principal sources of information. Also, you don't lock yourself in. There's no purpose in locking yourself in other than creating a situation with artificially inflated drama. And you don't want to do it at night unless the apparition only appears at night. But lots of apparitions appear during the day. And so there's no reason to go at night unless the phenomenon is somehow something that only manifests at night, which is not the norm. So what a normal paranormal investigator will do, notice the play on words there, is they will do initial interviews with the witnesses. And this is not only the people who report observing the phenomena, but everybody who is connected with the environment. Because let's say you got a household of five people, three of them say they've seen an apparition there, two of them say they haven't. You want to talk to all five. because the two that say they haven't seen an apparition may be able to provide you with valuable information that could shed light on what's going on in the situation. You want to make a list of all the reported phenomena, and then you want to make another list of all the possible explanations, both natural and paranormal, for those reported phenomena. And then you go down the list and you see which, starting with the normal explanations, because normal phenomena are more common than paranormal phenomena. So you start with the normal explanations and see if they check out. Like if someone says, oh, there's a cold spot in this part of the room, could the air conditioning, you know, be causing that cold spot?
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's something about the structure of the house that directs a heavy amount of airflow from the air conditioner to that spot, in which case it's perfectly normal. And usually, even when there is something paranormal happening in a location, usually there's also some of what is being reported has a normal explanation. The reason for that is confirmation bias. Once people begin to entertain the hypothesis that they have something paranormal going on in their environment, suddenly that becomes the default explanation. So if you think there's a ghost in your house, suddenly everything that's strange gets attributed to the ghost. Or if you think there's a poltergeist in your house, suddenly everything that is strange gets attributed to that poltergeist. But a lot of it may have perfectly normal explanations. I know one case, it's called the 21st Century Poltergeist. I did an episode of Mysterious World on it, where there was a little boy in North Carolina who was having poltergeist effects on electronic devices. So the, you know, when his grandmother would try to use the printer, it would feed every sheet of paper through the printer, and then she'd have to reload it, and then it would print what she wanted. And their washing machine burned out, and they had to get a new one, and it burned out, and they had to get a new one. And their phone would ring with no one there unless you put it under a metal cover. So he's having all these effects on electronic devices. One of them that they thought he was affecting was the garage door opener. It would just open sometimes or fail to open sometimes, and it was behaving erratically. So then the investigators come in, they look at all these different phenomena. There's no normal explanation for a bunch of them, including the toaster oven going on when it is not plugged in. But when it came to the garage door opener, they had faulty wiring. That was all it was with the garage door. It was totally natural. And it's normal to find some natural phenomena, even when it's mixed in with paranormal phenomena. On the other hand, there are also cases where, even though the situation is really weird, it's all natural. There was a case of a house in California where one room made people feel sick, and there were bursts of fire out in the backyard, and it turned out, and there was like a charge that make your skin tingle. Okay, the charge that made your skin tingle was caused by the fact the architect who built the house was avant-garde and had filled the walls with foam of the kind that generates static electricity. And they could show this by taking a fluorescent light bulb, just the bulb, and waving it around, and it lights up because of the static coming out of the walls. And the one room made people feel sick because the avant-garde architect had not properly squared all the corners of the room at 90 degrees, and so they were all a little bit off of 90 degrees. And your brain's trying to make sense of that and conform them to 90 degrees, and it's not working, and it makes you feel weird. And there were bursts of fire in the backyard because they had built on a garbage dump, and it was methane leaking up from the ground, and the static from the walls is igniting the methane. So even though it sounds like something out of a horror movie, it was all totally normal. Yes, there are serious scientifically oriented investigations of what's going on in paranormal field experiences. And there are courses taught, for example, at the Ryan Education Center teaching you about those if you want to take them.
Flame of the West, thank you very much for the question. Hidden in that answer, a possible energy source. We could use ghost power if it can make toast. We need to harness this power, Jimmy.
That wasn't actually a ghost, though. Most poltergeists are really caused by live-in agents. And that was the case with this little boy. He was the poltergeist agent. He was the cause of the phenomena. But he really did. There's this moment, and this I have my guest, who was the investigator, talks about this in the Mysterious World episode, where I just love this episode because he and the other investigator have been there interviewing the family for several hours, and it's getting past lunchtime and they've already eaten. But he thinks, hey, the family hadn't eaten. Maybe they need to. And so he says, do you guys need to make lunch or anything? And the mom says, oh, yeah, I'll go do that. And so they took a break. And the little boy, who was like 11 years old at the time, got so excited about his mom making a sandwich. And he's literally hopping up and down going, oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. And I love how an 11-year-old can be excited by something like a sandwich, you know. But he's just so excited. He's hopping up and down. And as he's doing that, the toaster oven turns on and it's not plugged in.
We need the power. We need the power. All right. That was from Flame of the West. We'll come back with more questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Catholic Influencers is a great podcast from Australia. It studies the weekly readings and breaks them down into layman's terms, showing you how they're relevant to our life today, making theology accessible for everyone. You can hear Catholic Influencers as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place, all free at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click Podcast Central today.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and all of our questions have come from the internet today. It's an internet Ask Me Anything. Jimmy gets lots and lots, and we do here at the offices as well, get lots of questions via the internet. Email questions come in, questions come via the various social media. And so it's fun to do these internet open forums from time to time. And it's also fun, quite frankly, because we get to hear from people we don't otherwise hear from, parts of the world where it might be inconvenient to call. And also we get questions that people might not ask on the air. And it's fun to get to those questions. Here's one from Favian. I'm not sure. I'm going to go with Favian. In light of recent studies on psychedelics, such as psilocybin or DMT, being an effective treatment for depression, PTSD, and smoking cessation, how can Catholics understand this, and how does it apply to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 2291?
Okay, so let's deal with the general question first, and then we'll look at paragraph 2291. Well, there has been recent research that shows that various psychedelic substances may have a therapeutic effect. And if so, well, that's fine. And Catholic moral theology would say in those circumstances where it would genuinely have a therapeutic effect, it would be morally illicit to use it, assuming that there are no, you know, counterbalancing factors, like it also causes big problems. If it is a net benefit to use it to treat some problem in a given situation, then all things being equal, you could use it. We want to be a little careful here, because number one, scientific fraud is rampant today. It's much more extensive than people realize. And secondly, because the history of claims regarding the therapeutic use of various psychedelic substances has been inflated. So there's a risk of any current scientific studies showing benefit that the science may be cooked. Because what happened with marijuana in the United States after it was made illegal in the early 20th century was by the mid to late 20th century, people said, well, maybe we can create a path to legalization by focusing initially on the therapeutic uses of marijuana, and we can get it legalized for that, and that can become the camel's nose in the tent that will then lead to widespread legalization. Now, having said that, I'm not saying whether marijuana should be totally illegal in all circumstances or totally legal in all circumstances or somewhere in between. I'm just saying it's a matter of historical record that this was the path that was used for legalization for marijuana. And in the process of working that path, individuals made claims for therapeutic uses of marijuana that were not backed up by sound scientific evidence. And so, various people want other drugs to also be legal, and they're using a similar strategy. So we have to be a little careful about these scientific claims about it's useful for this or it's useful for that. Frankly, we're at the beginning of such research, and I think that's a bad thing. I think the U.S., when it banned these substances, it so restricted them that you couldn't effectively do research with them. And that had the effect of delaying our knowledge of, well, maybe it, even if it should be allowed for general use, maybe it has some specific uses that are okay. And we're only at the beginning of that research because of how hard the U.S. cracked down on these. I think it would have been better for the U.S. to allow scientific research so we could find out, do they actually have genuine uses? So that's what I would say about the matter in general. If they really do have therapeutic uses that are not counterbalanced by other problems, then it would be morally legitimate to use them in those circumstances. Okay, so what about paragraph 2291 of the Catechism? It reads as follows. The use of drugs inflicts very grave damage on human health and life. Their use, except on strictly therapeutic grounds, is a grave offense. Clandestine production of and trafficking in drugs are scandalous practices. They constitute direct cooperation in evil since they encourage people to practices gravely contrary to the moral law. Okay, the first thing that leaps out at me about this paragraph is the use of the word drugs. Drugs is an English colloquialism that can refer to any pharmaceutical. So like aspirin's a drug, you know, metoprolol, that's a beta blocker, that's a drug, but people don't take aspirin or metoprolol to get high. And so in English, drugs also has a second usage, which means a drug you take to get high. And that's the usage that's being used here in the English translation. But English is not Latin, and therefore the Latin typical edition of the Catechism is almost certain to say something other than drugs here. It's not going to follow English usage. So my first question is, what does the Latin typical edition of the Catechism say here? And the answer, because I looked it up, is instead of saying drugs, it says stupefactivorum medicamentorum, which would mean stupefying medications. So a medication you take to get stupefied. In other words, a medicine you take to get high. And so that's what the Catechism says, and it's not inconsistent with what I just reeled off, on the basis of Catholic moral theology. It says the use of stupefying medications inflicts very grave damage on human health and life. Their use, except on strictly therapeutic grounds, is a grave offense. So if you're just getting stupefied every day, that's going to cause harm. That's a grave offense. But you can do them for therapeutic reasons. If you really have a condition that will be successfully treated by the use of a stupefying medication, then you can use the stupefying medication. You just don't want to ruin your life with it. Then there's the second thing that the the paragraph says, which concerns clandestine production and trafficking in, and it uses the same term, stupefying medications. It says that the clandestine production and trafficking of stupefying medications are scandalous practices, and they involve cooperation with evil since they encourage people to practices contrary to the moral law. And all that remains true, but all of that doesn't have anything to do with the strictly therapeutic use of them. So I would say that if it turns out that in a particular situation, psilocybin or DMT or something else has a therapeutic effect that is not counterbalanced by some other problem, then it could be used in those situations. And paragraph 2291 of the Catechism would agree.
Thank you, Fabian, very much for the question. I do hope that was helpful to you. This one comes from Travis. Jimmy, what are your thoughts on reverse speech?
Okay, so we should explain what reverse speech is. This is something that became popular a couple of decades ago through the agency of a gentleman, I believe he's Australian, named David John Oates. And what David John Oates would do is take recordings of people and reverse them and then listen to them. And he thought that he heard significant messages in these reverse speech tracks that either revealed something significant or, maybe revealed the ulterior motives of the person who was speaking at the time. For example, a famous one, he took Neil Armstrong's speech where he first steps on the moon and says that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, or that's what he intended to say. And he really did say that. It's just the audio on part of it got dropped, and so it sounds like he said something slightly different. But if you study the audio closely, it's really there. Well, David John Oates reversed that, and he thought he heard Neil Armstrong saying, "Man will spacewalk." And he thought, "Man will spacewalk," that's a somehow significant reversed summary of what Neil Armstrong was doing at the time as he was stepping onto the moon, even though technically stepping onto the moon is not a spacewalk. A spacewalk is what you do when you go extravehicular and you're not on a planet. So that's what he thought. And he thought that he developed this idea that as we're talking, every, minute or two, we say something that if you reverse it, is revealing, and it may be revealing about someone's motives. So, for example, he would reverse the speech of politicians and, talking about, let's say, some policy they want to implement, and he would claim that he heard something that indicated that they're insincere, that they have some ulterior motive that they don't consciously reveal, but it subconsciously comes out if you reverse their speech. Okay, so that's the basic concept of reverse speech. What do I think of it? Not much. It is very, very improbable that that individuals are on a subconscious level planning their forward speech in such a way that if you exactly reverse the syllables, it will say something else that happens to spill their most significant thoughts and deepest secrets. That's just very, very implausible. And it has not been backed up by other scientific evidence. I think that what's really happening in this case is what's known as apophenia. Apophenia is the tendency of humans to find patterns in random data. I remember like when I was a kid and we had televisions that were not hooked up to cable, so we were using an antenna, and after the TV stations went off at night, there wouldn't be any incoming signal and we'd see static. And I remember looking at the static, which is just random patterns of, light and dark, and I would see if I looked at it for a minute or two, I'd start to see spinning wheels in the static and stuff like that. And those were creations of my brain. Humans are pattern matching machines. We look for patterns and we'll see them even when they're not there. And there's an evolutionary reason for that. It benefits our survival. If you are a caveman, and you hear a rustling in the grass, you could either think, oh, that's just the wind, or you could think that could be a dangerous predator about to leap out and pounce on me. Well, if you assume that's just the wind and it's really a dangerous predator and it leaps out and pounces on you, you don't get to pass on your genes to the next generation. On the other hand, if you have a different set of genes, and when you, oops, there's the break, I'll finish on the other side.
Travis, I feel like I want to be very careful about what I say because I don't want it to get reversed now. We'll come back with more with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy was actually in the middle of answering Travis's question. Travis's question was, the other way. What are your thoughts on reverse speech?
Yeah, and I actually hit a pretty good cliffhanger for us because I was considering the question of why humans are such pattern finders.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that, you know, if you're a caveman and the bushes are rustling and you assume it's the wind, when really it's a predator that pounces on you, then you don't get to contribute your genes to the next generation. And that's where we ended. On the other hand, if you are a caveman and the bushes rustle and you assume it's a predator, when really it's just the wind, then you do get to pass on your genes to the next generation. So there's an inherent bias in favor of looking at meaningless data. It really was just the wind, and assuming there's something meaningful there, like predator. So we have an inbuilt margin of error, a safety bias to keep us safe and let us pass on our genes that favors seeing a meaning in meaningless data. And that is known as apophenia. There are also more specific versions of it. But like pareidolia is where you do that with random visual data. So when I would see the wheels spinning in the static on the TV screen late at night, that would be pareidolia. But apophenia is more general than that, and all reverse speech is apophenia. If you listen to enough random data, like what speech is when it's reversed, then you're periodically going to find patterns that strike you as meaningful, and that's all reverse speech is.
Travis, thanks. Apophenia. Do you remember quadrophenia?
Well, yes, by the Who.
Yeah, there. Jimmy, you can't get past him. Ben wants to know this. Jimmy, what is the church's teaching on usury or on economic injustice?
Well, the church teaches that usury is bad and economic injustice is also bad. But beyond that, it's going to get a little tricky because the church's understanding of what counts as usury has changed over time. And originally it was assumed that any taking of interest is usury, but that was under an economic system where the economy was viewed as a zero-sum game, where in order for some people to get ahead, other people had to lose. And eventually it was realized that the economy is not a zero-sum game, and there are situations where taking interest can be beneficial, not just for the person who receives the interest, but for the person who receives the loan on which interest is taken. And that can actually stimulate investment and growth of the economy. And that's actually been part of capitalism, which has been the most successful strategy in world history for lifting people out of poverty. And so these days, the church has a modified understanding of what usury is. It would basically be, I think the fairest way to assess it would be, it's taking excessive interest, too much, so much interest that it is harmful to the people involved rather than helpful to the overall economy. But exactly what that rate is, it's going to be up for debate. And right now, the market mechanism to set prices, including interest rates, is kind of the best thing we got going for making that determination. When it comes to economic injustice, well, again, the church is going to say economic injustice is bad, just like any form of injustice is bad. But you got to spell out what you mean by economic injustice. You got to look at a particular situation and say, okay, so what about this is unjust? And that's going to vary. If anything is unjust about it, it's going to vary from one situation to another. So if you're encountering folks who are using terms like usury in a way that does not reflect the fact that some taking of interest is good, or can be good, I would say that those are problematic people. And if you're encountering folks who are saying this situation involves economic injustice and they're not spelling out how, and you haven't cross-checked, or is there another side to the story, then you want to be careful around those people too, because a lot of people will just label things bad or good without really looking at it from a critical point of view that considers both perspectives, because there's usually more than one on any given subject.
All right. I hope that was helpful to you, Ben. Thank you very much for the question. The next question comes from Nocturne 2029. I'm pregnant with my first child. When I receive the Eucharist, does my baby also receive?
Well, so when you receive the Eucharist, the consecrated elements are broken down by your digestive system, and some of the results of that may be molecules that eventually get into your bloodstream, and they go down to your womb, where they're transferred via the placenta into the unborn child. So it's possible that some of the post-digestion products of the consecrated elements are going to make it to your child, but they're not going to have the real presence, because the real presence remains only as long as the elements appear to be consumable bread and drinkable wine. Once the digestion process starts, those appearances quickly go away, and so does the real presence. And so your child would be receiving remnants of the consecrated elements but they no longer have the real presence. That's not to say you can't make a spiritual act of communion favoring your child and ask Jesus to bless your child, but your child would not be literally receiving Jesus in the Eucharist when you receive communion, because before any such products get to your child, they would have passed through your digestive system and lost the real presence.
Nocturne, many prayers for you and the baby. Thank you for the question.
Yeah.
Angela wants to know this. What I get from the online discourse is that the only mood for Mass is reverence. I get that this is because of the sacrifice of Christ at the cross, but then why can't I feel joy or excitement? Or if I can, when is it appropriate to show it and how? Also, some resources for learning about liturgy would be nice.
Okay, so I'm sure you found people who are online saying stuff like the only appropriate mood to have in the liturgy is reverence, and you shouldn't get excited or whatever. And I would say those folks are wrong. There is not one single response to liturgy. It's compatible with multiple different moods. And so we see an example of that in the case of David, when he brought the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. It had been stored elsewhere, but he brought it to Jerusalem, and he was leading the procession, escorting the Ark, and he danced. He was experiencing joy, and he danced. And we know that was okay with God, because his wife, his first wife, Michael, was looking down on him, both literally and figuratively. It's like she was up, I guess, in a second floor, watching David leading the procession and dancing, and she got in a snit about it. And she accused David of behaving like some common man who would dance. This was not dignified. He needed to just be reverent in the presence of the Ark of the Covenant. This excitable dancing stuff is certainly not for the King of Israel. And we're told by the sacred author, therefore, she had no children till the day she died, indicating that it was just fine with God for David to express his joy by dancing. So reverence is one good response to the presence of the sacred. So is joy. So is excitement. They can all have their own places. I have seen, just with former Catholic Answers chaplains, how different the liturgy is celebrated by different priests. We had two chaplains at one point. One of them was Father Earl Riviera, and one of them was Father Ray Ryland. And they were as different as night and day. They both celebrated the liturgy totally, you know, liturgically in a proper way, but it was just so different. Father Earl was very contemplative, very solemn, very reverent. Father Ray was so joyful. And they were both perfectly wonderful celebrations of the Mass. They were just different. And so so there's more than one affective or emotional response that's appropriate to the presence of the sacred, including Christ in the Eucharist. You can feel reverent. You can feel joyful. You can feel excited. There's all of those are appropriate. So she asks, can she show this? Well, at a Mass, you need to do it within what the liturgical law allows. You know, you can be excited. You just don't want to be disruptive with your excitement, you know. You want to as the saying goes, you want to say the black and do the red. The black is what the people and the priest, but what the people say in the liturgical books, the red are the rubrics, the instructions for what the people do. So you want to follow the rubrics, you want to say the appropriate words, but you can say them reverently, you can say them joyfully, you can say them excitedly. All of those things are fine. And since she asked about what are some resources for learning about the liturgy, well, if you want to learn about the Mass, I would recommend getting my book, Mass Revision. It goes through the liturgical law of the Mass in great detail. Unfortunately, it's not available in print right now, but it is available electronically. So you can get a Kindle copy of Mass Revision and read it and find out about what the liturgical law is for the Mass in a lot of detail. And as you do that, opportunities to do things in a way that best express your particular reaction to the Mass should emerge.
Angela, thank you. Brought us right to the break with that question. I hope that answer was helpful to you. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything, the internet version with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, "When we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue." Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1999. The shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament of Our Lady of the Angels Monastery in Hansville, Alabama is consecrated. Mother Angelica says, "The happiest day of my life was the day this church was dedicated."
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. The time is just flying. Getting through questions here with Jimmy Akin. All the questions have come from the internet today. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Check out his, he's got many podcasts. You can check out the Jimmy Akin podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or he's on with lots of other people. And this show is a podcast as well. So you can pretty much, if you enter the podcasting world, you're probably going to bump into Jimmy Akin at some point. Do check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World if you are at all interested in mysteries. Very popular, and more than 300 mysteries to investigate. Coming up on 400 mysteries to investigate with Jimmy. This question, Jimmy, comes from Noir CC. If God picks your time of death, wouldn't this mean he could choose if you go to heaven or hell? Because your will might be at point A towards God and at point B against God.
So the answer is a definite maybe. It depends. Now, notice our starting premise here. If God picks the time of your death. So that's our starting premise. But that's all that Noir CC has said, is God picks it. He doesn't say on what basis does God pick it. If God picks it on the basis of what state you are in spiritually at the time, then yes, God would be choosing whether you go to heaven or hell. If he sees, aha, Sai's in a state of grace right now, I want him to go to heaven, so here's his moment, and you die at that moment, then God would be choosing to have you go to heaven. On the other hand, if God sees, oh, Sai is not in a state of grace at the moment, I don't want him to go to heaven, so now's his moment, and then you would die and go to hell. So God would be choosing for you to go to heaven or hell if he's choosing the moment of your death based on the spiritual state you are in at the time. But maybe he's not doing that. That's why I said the answer to this one is a definite maybe. Maybe God has determined that Sai will have a lifespan of 90 years and one day. And when that 90 years and one day happens, Sai dies. But God just determined the length. He didn't pick the length based on Sai's spiritual state. So in that case, it's up to Sai. If Sai is in a state of grace on his 90th year and first day, the day after his 90th birthday, technically it would be technically it would be after, if he's just turned the way we normally speak, 90 years would mean he's just turned 90. So technically, it's the first day of his 91st year. So if on the first day of his 91st year, Cy chooses to be in a state of grace, then Cy goes to heaven. And if on the first day of his 91st year, Cy chooses not to be in a state of grace, then Cy is not going to go to heaven. But it's Cy who's making the choice there, not God doing it. All God did was determine this is how much time you get, and then it's Cy's job to determine what he does with that time. So if God picks the time of your death, maybe it involves God choosing whether you go to heaven or hell, or maybe it doesn't. Since we're told that God doesn't want anyone to go to hell, I would be skeptical of the idea that God is choosing when someone dies if they are not in a state of grace to purposefully damn them. I would suspect that something else is happening at those times, because that's inconsistent with what we're told about God's will for the salvation of all. On the other hand, he may say for some people, okay, I've given you bunches of chances and you're just not repentant, so now is the time. But that's not him wanting to send the person to hell. That's him regretting the person is not repenting when he's given them loads of opportunities to repent. Also, you'll notice I mentioned we have a starting premise. If God picks the time of your death. Well, there are certainly passages in the Bible, especially the Old Testament, that use language like that. But there's always a question we have to consider about how literally are those passages meant. Because one of the things we know about Hebrew, especially in the Old Testament, about Hebrew speech, is there's a tendency to talk as if God is responsible for everything. And that reflects the fact that God has an underlying providence where, you know, he could stop something from happening if he chose. And so if he lets something happen, well, he at least allowed it, but that didn't mean he positively chose it. However, the Israelite authors, especially in the Old Testament, tend to make it sound like God did choose it. But it's not certain that that's meant to be taken literally. That may just be their mode of speech for doing honor to God by talking as if he's responsible for everything and not mentioning that there are subsidiary causes that God has included within his providence. So even though there are passages in the Old Testament that make it sound like God chooses the time of people's death, we may not be meant to take those literally. There may be more free agency involved. For example, you know, look at the case of suicides. If someone decides to pull out a gun and end their life, and by the way, don't do that, it is not going to help. That only creates more problems. But if someone does that, well, clearly they're choosing the time of their death. I mean, assuming they have free will, they're choosing it. And God may have allowed it to happen, but that doesn't mean God chose for them to do that. In fact, we know that God is opposed to suicide, so he didn't choose for them to do this. So, you know, there are other reasons to question this starting premise of, does God pick the time of your death?
Noir, thank you very much for that very interesting question. This next one, I'll try to stretch it out a little bit. It's from Reed Richards. If a person...
There you go. I saw what you did there.
Right, thank you. If a person is prayed for that may already be in heaven, can those prayers help other family members or someone else who might be in need of those prayers?
Well, I don't, you know, want to be an elongated man or a elastic lad or a plastic man, so I'll try to keep my answer short. If a person is prayed for that may already be in heaven, can those prayers help other family members or someone else who might need them? Well, this is a common thing that you hear from a lot of Catholic parents. You know, they'll tell their children, if you're praying for someone, you know, they'll tell their children, pray for someone like grandma or whoever who may have passed on. And the kids will say, well, what if grandma's already in heaven? What happens with my prayers then? And the parents don't want to take the attitude that, oh, well, sorry, you're wasting your time then. So they have invented a folk explanation of, oh, don't worry, your prayer will help someone else who needs it. Well, that could happen. You know, God could redirect the benefits of prayer from grandma to someone else who's not yet in heaven. But I don't consider that a certain answer, because you're not literally praying for someone else. I mean, you are if you incorporate, oh, or if grandma's in heaven, please apply this to someone else. I mean, you would be in that case. But this just is not a necessary assumption. Because there are other ways God can handle prayers when at a given point in time, someone is already in heaven. And this isn't just my view. This is Pope Benedict XVI's view. He pointed out in his encyclical Spes Salvi, when he talked about purgatory and talked about praying for those in purgatory, that the duration of purgatory cannot be calculated in earthly time. And therefore, your prayers for those who are in purgatory can be applied to the person when they're in purgatory, even though we have no way of calculating when that is from an earthly perspective. In other words, even let's suppose grandma got into heaven back in 2009, and I'm praying for grandma in 2024. God is outside of time. And so from his eternal now, outside of time, God sees my prayer for grandma in 2024. And because he's outside of time, he can apply it to grandma back in 2009 and help get her out of purgatory. So the idea that God needs to reroute our prayers is fundamentally mistaken. I mean, he could, but it's not necessary, because he sees all of our prayers, all in all of history, all in a flash, and can apply them wherever they're needed. So if I'm praying for grandma in purgatory, then it doesn't matter when grandma is in purgatory or when I pray for her. God can take my prayers for her whenever they occur and apply them to her when she's in purgatory. And so all those prayers, you can think of them as smart prayers. They seek their target. And they help the person that you mean to pray for. I've got a whole episode of Mysterious World on this. It's about time travel prayer. And so if you look up Jimmy Akin time travel prayer, you can hear all about this subject in more detail.
Thank you, Reed Richards. Fantastic question. This one comes from Grace. If every man, woman, and child had to partake in the Passover meal in order to be saved, regardless of their age, why isn't it the same for the Eucharist now? Why do Catholics now wait until their first communion? Were all people, regardless of age, partaking in the New Testament times?
Well, so it wasn't the case that every man, woman, and child had to partake of the Passover meal in order to be saved. On the original Passover, they had to celebrate the Passover in order for the angel of death to pass over their house, but their own individual salvation was not on the line. They were being saved from the angel of death, but they weren't being saved from their sins or being saved from hell or anything like that. Later on, it was understood that there were reasons why someone might not be able to receive to participate in the Passover meal. In fact, in later times would have a second Passover for people who were not able to do it the first time. For example, you might be sick. You know, sickness was common in the ancient world. You might have an intestinal bug and not be able to keep any food down, you know, or you might have been in a coma or any number, and then you got better. And there are any number of reasons why you might not be able to keep the Passover. So the starting premise that every man, woman, and child needed to partake in the Passover in order to be saved is mistaken. And that consequently, you know, God is able to give his grace to children even before they've been able to be initiated into the Eucharist. Their salvation is still secure as long as they don't commit mortal sin. And little kids aren't really good at committing mortal sin. So after they're baptized, their salvation's secure. Personally, I would favor giving communion to infants like happens in some Eastern churches, including Catholic ones, but it's not the Western discipline.
Thanks, Grace. Thank you, Jimmy. Enjoyed those 2 hours.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.